Hi, this is Barry List at INFORMS, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science of Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. In counterterrorism, intelligence and good information is key. But how do you process massive amounts of intelligence data? And how do you mine that data to prevent an attack on civilians? In today's segment, we talk to Professor Edward H. Kaplan of Yale University. Professor Kaplan is the author of a new study called Terror Cues, which appears in the July 2010 issue of the INFORMS Journal Operations Research. He's conducted several studies on counterterrorism in connection with the Technion Yale Initiative in Homeland Security and Counterterror Operations Research. Professor Kaplan, welcome to the Science of Better.
Thanks, Barry. Pleased to be here.
You established a reputation using math modeling in public health and won awards for your evaluation of a needle exchange program in New Haven near Yale. How did you become interested in counterterrorism?
Well, after the 9/11 terror attacks and the anthrax letters later that month, I was contacted by an official at the National Institutes of Health, or the NIH, who was charged with organizing a meeting to investigate how mathematical models might assist policymakers with planning and response to bioterrorism events. The idea was to get a few modelers together with key policy advisors to map out basic needs and evaluate existing response strategies. Smallpox was at the top of the list. So basically, they wanted to see if something similar to the modeling approaches I had developed for evaluating HIV prevention programs would work for bioterror attacks. With Larry Wine and David Kraft, I developed models for emergency response to smallpox and anthrax attacks.
By the way, who are Larry Wine and Mr. Kraft?
Larry, at the time, was a professor at MIT. Now he's a professor of operations research at Stanford, and David was Larry's PhD student.
I see. Okay.
But anyway, so we developed these models for emergency response to smallpox and anthrax attacks, and I communicated our findings and recommendations widely to relevant decision makers in the U.S. and in Israel. And I visited Israel numerous times to talk about these issues during 2002-2003, which coincided with the Second Intifada, when Israel was under incessant attack from suicide bombers. So it was at that time that I became interested in evaluating the effectiveness of different approaches to countering suicide bombings, and things kind of took off from there.
And which brings us to the question you mentioned, Israel. What is the Technion, Yale Initiative? Technion is an institute in Israel.
That's right, the Technion Israel Institute of Technology. It's widely described as the MIT of Israel. So this research project actually was made possible through the generosity of Daniel Rose. He's the chairman of Rose Associates, which is one of New York City's best-known real estate firms. And with the funds from his gift, what this does is it brings together operations researchers from both the Technion and Yale to explore new problems in homeland security and counterterrorism. The idea is to develop tools for decision-making and policy analysis. So let me just mention a few lines of research so you can get a sense of what we're up to.
Okay.
One line of research addresses homeland security resource allocation. For example, how might the Department of Homeland Security think about allocating its funds earmarked for protecting U.S. population centers or critical infrastructure across U.S. states and territories?
And that's the kind of boring stuff of government that is extremely important.
It's extremely important, and actually, in a completely different context, proved very interesting. Past work I did on resource allocation had to do with HIV prevention. How should the government allocate funds to target different populations to prevent HIV infections? It's the same basic question of how should one allocate large amounts of money to programs in different cities and states. A different problem in resource allocation, given limited resources, which countermeasures should a defender develop and how much should be invested in their development so as to minimize the damage caused by attackers' weapons over a certain time horizon? There's this cat and mouse game that goes back and forth between terrorists and the government. And so the issue is always one of having a temporary advantage and neutralizing the current fad, as it were.
But then your opponent steps in and makes a change based on the change you've made. Is that right?
That's exactly right. So you can see this cat and mouse game in terrorism and insurgencies around the world. In Israel, for example, people may not remember this, but at the beginning of the Intifada, suicide bombings were not, in fact, the dominant mode of attack. Instead, what you had were shooting attacks on Israeli civilians and also on motorists on the roads. So Israel's response to that was to limit access to the roads and to put up blast walls around outlying neighborhoods in the towns which were coming under attack. It was only then that the suicide bombing campaign started. That has been brought under control, and of course now what we have for a period of time were these rockets coming in, the Qassam rockets being fired from Gaza, and that stopped with the operation Cast Lead of last year. So basically there's this cat and mouse game which goes on, task exchange, there's a response, there's a switch in tactics and so on. And the same thing happens in Iraq as well. IEDs take many different flavors, and so again you have the measure countermeasure. A very common fact that one has to deal with in these kinds of asymmetric conflicts.
Which brings us to your study. The introduction to your study mentions examples of counterterror operations from MI5 in England and in Israel, which you've mentioned a little bit of, that are related to your research. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. In the spring of 2007, the MI5, which is Britain's Internal Security Service, reported that they were monitoring about 2,000 al-Qaeda sympathizers in the United Kingdom. Some people thought, wow, 2,000 al-Qaeda sympathizers, that's scary. But other people thought, really, only 2,000? I would have thought more. But my reaction was, gee, how many al-Qaeda sympathizers would MI5 think there are if they doubled the number of MI5 agents, or if they have them for that matter? I mean,
that's,
if you didn't have any agents,
thought,
you wouldn't observe anybody.
Uh-huh.
So it hit me that the estimated size of a terror threat depends not only on how big the threat really is, but also on how hard you're looking for terrorists or their accomplices. Now, in Israel, a lot of my prior work was evaluating the effectiveness of counter-suicide bombing tactics, and those studies pointed to intelligence as the key component. The best way to stop attacks is to find out about them and interdict the terrorists before the attack happens. But as with the MI5, the rate with which you can detect and stop terror attacks depends both upon the number of actual plots that are in progress and the resources, for example, the number of undercover agents and or informants that are invested in detecting terror plots. So my paper builds upon those two insights.
The abstract of the paper says that it presents the first math models for understanding the infiltration and interdiction of ongoing terror plots by undercover intelligence agents. And I guess I'm wondering what you're trying to accomplish, and the trickier question is, can you explain your model in terms that the layman can understand?
Well, let me give it a whirl. The goal is to understand and actually to estimate the fraction of terror plots that can be interdicted, stopped, as a function of the number of undercover agents or informants that are deployed by services such as the Israel Security Agency, that's also known as the Shin Bet or the Shabak, or Britain's MI5, or U.S. agencies such as the FBI, or even the Intelligence Division of the New York City Police Department, NYPD. A second goal is actually to estimate how many undetected terror threats are really out there based on knowing the real-time status of your undercover agents. For example, whether they have currently infiltrated plots in progress or whether they have certain individuals under surveillance, but as of yet no definitive information linking them to terrorism. If the estimated number of ongoing but undetected plots is high, then that would suggest that additional undercover resources are needed to increase the detection rate. On the other hand, if you really don't estimate that there are many more plots beyond those that you know about, then maybe the current effort is sufficient.
You also mentioned that part of your research is a false detection model. How does that fit in?
Okay, this is actually pretty important. Undercover agents, like anyone else, can make mistakes. Making mistakes in this game means that you end up devoting time and energy to following persons who actually don't have anything to do with terrorism. And that's all the more likely when you realize that if you're a terrorist, a pretty good tactic is to deliberately spread false information with the intent of misleading government agents. So such false detection can lead both to tracking and sometimes the arrest of innocent persons, but at the same time it can effectively lessen the rate with which agents can detect real plots, since time is wasted running around after fake threats. This is really important and a real feature of counterterror operations. That's why it's in the model.
Tell us a little about queuing theory and how a technique often associated with bank lines and telecommunications applies to counterterrorism.
Yeah, it may not be the first thing you would think of. So let me talk first about queuing theory itself. It's most often associated with characterizing and improving the service environment for customers waiting in banks or on the phone when service is provided via call centers, or for that matter, for patients in hospitals. Queuing theory goes all the way back to the 1910s in the work of Agnar Erlang, who was a mathematician and an engineer for the Copenhagen Telephone Company. And typically, what queuing models provide is both descriptive information about the number of customers in a system, people waiting and receiving service, how long they have to wait to receive service, Also, things like how many customers will drop out of a system or be denied entry because the system is overloaded and so forth. But the second use of queuing models is to determine the number of servers needed to staff such server systems to balance the trade-off between the cost of customer waiting and service provision, or alternatively, to guarantee certain features of the customer waiting experience. For example, 95% of all customers should receive service within 30 seconds of arrival. Now, to see how terrorism can be framed as a queuing problem, let's play the following game. Consider newly hatched terror plots as newly arriving customers to a service system. Consider undercover agents as the service providers in that system. Consider the detection of terror plots as the service provided. And what about successful terror attacks? Well, those are customers who drop out of the system before they receive service. Now, this is one service system where, from the government's point of view, it's really important to provide good service. On the other hand, from the customer's point of view, lousy and ideally no service is preferred.
So that's the unusual difference between the way you would apply queuing theory to a consumer situation and how you would apply it here.
Sure. There's another big difference. In most queuing systems, the service providers can see the customers. If you're walking into a bank, the tellers can see you. If you log on to an online system, your login is recognized. But with terror queues, the servers have to find the customers. That is, the intelligence agents have to find the would-be terrorists, and the customers don't want to be found.
And it's unusual that you came up with this application, since queuing theory, as you say, is entirely thought of as a service to a customer, and here you're doing something quite the opposite, but you found the applicability. Let me move on and ask you why it's important to create your terror queue.
Well, it's pretty simple, because with terror queues, the queue of customers, as I said earlier, it corresponds exactly to the number of terror plots that have already started but haven't been detected yet. So knowing how big the queue is means that you can estimate how many terror plots are out there that haven't been detected. Queuing theory gives you a body of methods for modeling customer queues in many different types of service systems. So what I've done is borrowed from that modeling literature to create a new method for estimating the number of ongoing yet undetected terror threats from basic intelligence data that describes the utilization of undercover agents and informants. So that's really the reason why I'm doing this. By casting it as a queue, I can use the tools of queuing theory to answer a very important question. How many undetected terror plots are there?
Which leads us to the question, how does this help those in intelligence make important decisions?
So I mentioned a little bit of this before. If the model suggests that the number of unknown threats is a lot bigger than the number of known threats, then you need more resources in terms of detection and interdiction. But there's another use for it, too, which goes back to resource allocation that we were talking about before. How many agents should be stationed in different geographic areas, for example? Or how many agents should be assigned to monitor different subgroups within the population? So there are basically a lot of suggestions that can come out of a model like this based on data which largely are being collected already anyhow but not being used for this purpose.
Let's look at some of your other research in counterterrorism. You published a study in the Informs Journal Interfaces in 2006 that examined the tactical prevention of suicide bombing. You compare the effectiveness of preventing arrests versus targeted assassination. Can you review the basic findings of that 2006 study?
Yeah, and actually this was one of the pieces of work that got me so interested in intelligence in the first place. The basic finding from Israel was that preventive arrests served to reduce downstream suicide bombings, both by interrupting specific plots that were associated with the arrest of terrorists, but also through the intelligence gathered from interrogations that led to further arrests. Targeted killings, on the other hand, while erasing an immediate threat, actually seemed to increase the number of downstream terror attacks. Now, a similar issue is faced today by the U.S. If you think about those drone operations targeting al-Qaeda militants in Pakistan, Yemen, and elsewhere, there are many observers who believe that such assassinations serve to recruit more terrorists than are eliminated. There was another result that came out of Israel that was really peculiar, and that was the following. Backlash terrorism only seemed to result when the terrorists themselves were the ones that were successfully targeted. That is, that the people who were being hunted in the targeted killings were successfully reached. But in those cases where operational errors led to the deaths of Palestinian civilians, terror groups like the Hamas and the Islamic Jihad actually seemed to refrain from retaliation. So perhaps in such cases, the terror organizations were satisfied to let the United Nations or other international bodies condemn Israel for having killed civilians. It was only when their own operatives were killed that you saw the backlash terrorism that everyone talks about.
One of your surprising studies looked at the consequences of using sensors in areas with lots of foot traffic, such as outdoor pedestrian malls or markets that would issue an alert if a suicide bomber was detected in the vicinity. What was the upshot of that research?
Oh, yeah, this was pretty interesting. The upshot was that sometimes, not always, but sometimes issuing a last-second alarm that would cause pedestrians to flee or hit the deck, as it were, could actually serve to increase the number of casualties rather than reduce them. And the reason is that with pedestrian suicide bombs, casualties are caused by shrapnel that fly out of the bomb, not by an explosive shockwave. So if people start to run away from a bomber, the number of unprotected people, that is, people with absolutely no obstruction between themselves and the bomb, that number can increase. Think of an expanding circle. As the circle expands, the circumference gets bigger, and so in this case, the circumference actually are people, and so the number of people who would be exposed increases, and more people could be killed by bomb fragments. And a similar sort of phenomenon can occur if everybody hits the deck. It creates a donut of sorts that leaves a larger ring of people who are exposed to bomb fragments. So there's a pretty tough trade-off here. After all, it's in every person's individual interest to try and get out of there so as to minimize the chance of getting struck by a bomb fragment. But if everybody tries to do that, more people could be killed than if no alarm had been issued at all and more people were protected by others in the crowd from flying bomb fragments. Basically, if someone is between you and the bomb, they're going to get hit, but in doing so, it leaves you perhaps unscathed.
But from the practical perspective, you were able to say that going to the expensive paying for and installing sensors was not beneficial.
In this particular case, you have the potential that the thing could backfire. It also turned out that the number of sensors one would need in order to give you sufficient time to even issue an alert, because after all, if you were going to use these kinds of sensors, you'd want to be able to issue warnings about bombs, not simply take pictures of them while they're exploding. There's very little time left from the time a bomb would be detected until they would go. So basically, this last-minute defense was not the way to go at all.
Let's turn to a study that you published in 2007 in the European Journal of Operations Research. In one of our previous podcasts, a professor at the Naval Postgraduate School talked about a serious fallacy in modeling terrorist risk. He was critical of modelers who analyze the possibility of a terrorist attack, portraying it as if they were modeling the probability of a hurricane touching down in New Haven. Can you discuss this rejection of modeling probability, as in the case of a natural event, and instead using game theory or related techniques that let you focus on a cunning enemy who's forever plotting?
Sure. The criticism, by the way, is not that you should never use probability in studying terrorists. The issue here is the fact that in a lot of these problems, terrorists can watch what you're doing. They can see what you're doing. Now, many people who study terrorism do so using a variant of risk analysis, and at the core, that does require assigning probabilities to events such as terror attacks. But terrorists are smart. They can observe how we defend ourselves. For example, terrorists know how intensively airline passengers are screened. This makes it harder, not impossible, but harder for someone to board a plane with a bomb. It also suggests what new forms of explosives might be smuggled on board. Think of Captain Underpants, that is the attempted Christmas Day brief bomber last year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, terrorists can also observe how we protect important buildings, factories, and so forth. In such an environment, it's more reasonable to model terrorists as intelligent decision makers who choose, and that's the key, who choose when and where to attack, as opposed to modeling terror attacks as the result of a coin toss. So game theory is probably the best modeling framework within which to study such terrorism problems.
To ask the question in a perhaps more complicated way, I hope not too complicated, what do you mean by probabilistic uncertainty versus strategic uncertainty?
Okay, probabilistic uncertainty can be thought of as choices made by nature. There are empirical frequencies with which certain events such as hurricanes, earthquakes, or I would argue even oil spills occur. It's not as if BP was trying to have an oil spill and timing it strategically to maximally hurt us. It was an accident, perhaps due to negligent behavior, but an accident nonetheless. Now, in none of the cases I've mentioned, hurricanes, earthquakes, oil spills, is somebody trying to strategically time or locate an attack. Strategic uncertainty, on the other hand, results from the decisions of intelligent, adversely interested parties. Terrorists certainly are good examples of intelligent, adversely interested parties. They want to hurt us. But there are other examples. For example, in business, business competition provides an instance where you, I think one would be foolhardy to model the choice of a competing firm as resulting from coin tosses, presuming past behavior predicts future firm performance. They are making intelligent choices to try and maximize their own profits, often at your own company's expense.
Has there been any reaction to your research from government officials or legislators who have to make funding or resource distinctions based on the form of modeling you've been talking about, whether positive or negative reaction?
Well, it's important to remember that this work is still very young. And so, and the other thing which is important to remember is that not all such reactions would be made public. What I can claim is that having presented the research to various Homeland Security officials, the basic ideas resonate. But I certainly can't say that the rules have changed in response to this particular resource allocation work. By the way, I've also presented a lot of the other research that I've been working on to government officials, and there I can say there are very high levels of interest, but I can't comment on where that's going at the moment.
You've also divined, or should I say modeled, the strategic decisions that a terrorist organization might make based on whether it takes a long or short-term approach. What were your findings there?
This was work with one of my colleagues, Jonathan Feinstein, also a professor at Yale, conducted under the Rose Initiative. The idea was to see how a rational terror organization would behave or decide. That is, an organization that is trying to maximize its own interests in a rational way, the same way that a business organization tries to grow. And so the issue here was, how would they divide their resources between small and large attacks when the goal is to maximize its own growth over time? And there's a couple of results that stand out. Even though one thinks of terrorists as planning spectacular attacks, there are risks to terror organizations from doing so. The more spectacular a planned attack, the better the chance that it's going to be detected or otherwise fail. After all, these things are complicated. Plus, the more such attacks cost. Terrorists thus risk a lot when they plan large attacks. And in our model, a rational terrorist organization does not plan for a large attack if they have just enough resources to do so. Rather, they will only focus on big attacks if they've got sufficient resources to ensure the consequences of failure, as it were. Second, what the model shows is that terror organizations are able to grow over time at an increasing rate by optimally combining small and large attacks. What I mean by that is that large organizations can grow faster than small ones. This points to the importance of containing terror organizations as early as possible in their evolution, for once they pass a certain critical scale, it becomes very, very hard to keep them in check.
You've looked at a related issue, insurgencies, specifically the strategic decision about when powerful government forces should take on elusive insurgents. Is your research applicable to the war in Afghanistan? You spoke about this a little bit before, but maybe you could expand.
Well, I think the paper you're talking about is one that was titled Confronting Entrenched Insurgents, which was created with the 2006 war between Hezbollah and Israel in mind. And in that war, Hezbollah rained missiles all over northern Israel. So failure to attack a given stronghold from which missile fire emanated meant certain losses to the Israeli environment, civilian infrastructure, and in some cases to population. It was not possible to neutralize all of the missile sites, so some sort of force allocation became necessary. Which strongholds to attack and with what level of force? Now, the same sorts of issues certainly exist in Afghanistan, in particular the very deep mixing of the Taliban with Afghani civilians, which makes direct assaults quite difficult. So while the two situations differ in the specifics, we don't really have the Taliban or Al-Qaeda raining missiles on civilian populations. The U.S. is still faced with fundamental questions regarding which Taliban strongholds to target and how much force to apply to each.
We only have time for a couple more questions. Can you tell us what future research you'll be doing in counterterrorism?
Well, I'm presently most interested in continuing to apply operations research to counterterror intelligence. I would call this sort of work intelligence operations research, where the idea is both to understand the processes by which intelligence information is created and analyzed, and also to use operations research to answer specific intelligence questions. There's a host of issues in this realm. For example, managing the trade-off between the collection and analysis of counterterror intelligence to maximize the rate with which you can interdict terror plots, or addressing the action timing problems of when to surface a source and go after a suspect. If you do it too soon, you can blow the source's cover without having enough information to convict the suspect. If you wait too long, you could end up facing an attempted attack. I'm also interested in looking at different components of counterterror intelligence to see which are more effective or decisive in leading to reducing the rate of terrorism. This is sort of in the same spirit as my earlier work in evaluating the effectiveness of different counter-suicide bombing techniques, where you take a look at the efforts that are being made in a wide variety of areas and try to understand how they work together, what the synergies are, and also perhaps if there are some counterproductive or at least non-productive intelligence activities going on.
That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Professor Edward Kaplan of Yale University. Professor Kaplan, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Barry.
And thank you for listening to the Science at Better podcast by INFORMS, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. For more about operations research and this series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.